Hola, this is Gustavo Arellano, columnist at the Los Angeles Times and host of the podcast, The Times, daily news from the LA Times. I'll be your guest host for the next few weeks. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the first week of July, and the country is still reeling from the Supreme Court's precedent-setting term and numerous mass shootings over the 4th of July weekend, including a gunman who opened fire at an Independence Day parade in Highland Park, Chicago, killing at least 7 people and wounding dozens more. Following the shooting, the White House released a statement where President Joe Biden pointed to a bipartisan bill he recently signed into law aimed at gun safety as a future life-saving measure. He added, quote, "But there is much more work to do, and I'm not going to give up fighting the epidemic of gun violence." But there are growing concerns about Biden's responses to recent events, which many Democrats are seeing as too tame. Now, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel to discuss. I'm your guest host in your center. I know, last time I was guest host, I was left, but here I am. On the right, I'm joined by Tim Carney, columnist at the Washington Examiner and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Gustavo. Glad to have you closer to me this time.
Let's see how far away I get from you. And on the left is Baratunde Thurston. He's a founding partner at PUC, cool publication, by the way, where he writes about democracy, race, technology, and climate. And he's also the host of the new PBS show, America Outdoors. Hello, Baratunde.
Hola, Gustavo. Good to be here.
Hola to all. In the past week, some very vocal Democrats are complaining about Biden's supposedly uninspired response to the Highland Park shooting. Democratic strategist Camille Rivera said in Politico, quote, "He's got a real excitability problem." Baratunde, do you agree with that assessment?
I mean, I actually do agree with the assessment, but not for those reasons. I think it is hard to get excited by Joe Biden. I didn't vote for Biden in the primary. I'm very glad he defeated Trump. I'm glad he's our president, but excitement isn't a word I associate with him. However, I got to be more forgiving on this point. I think it's very difficult for any American president to do or say anything that would excite the public when we've seen how meager the response has been to decades of gun violence unfettered. And so I feel like some of these presidents, you know, they believe in the American people and we're the greatest country ever. And then they get in office and they realize the limits of their ability to actually move the country and channel some better version of ourselves. So it is a very depressing moment. Every mass shooting is a deadly reminder, literally, of our ineffectiveness as people to protect ourselves. So I don't put that on Biden. I put that on the culture of the nation. I put that on the fact that we have more guns than people in this country. And that is not an excitable point right there. That's a really sad point to me.
Tim, I'm surprised by people critiquing Biden for being too supposedly lethargic because the stereotype of him as vice president is that he got too excited about things. Do you think if we got that Joe, Americans would react better to what he says and what he proposes?
Well, first of all, that Joe wasn't yet 79 years old. The man turns 80 in November. It is cruel to think that he's going to be, you know, having to do this incredibly exhausting, incredibly thankless job for a couple more years at least. And so, yeah, he's not as young as he used to be. And also, I need to sort of endorse what Baratunde said there, which is I'll say it a little stronger. The problems are sicknesses in our culture, and the president has a limited ability to change that. Now, you could blame it on gun culture, and I won't disagree. You could blame it on Republicans or whatever. But Joe Biden is facing problems that he lacks the ability to fix. And part of the problem here is that he convinced a lot of people the only problems with our country is because Donald Trump is president. And now that Donald Trump's not president and we still have a bunch of problems, this is why it's coming down on him, because he had convinced people that he alone could fix it, and he couldn't.
I also think, though, that I get it. The president can only do so much. We have three branches in this democracy, at least so far. But people are always looking for that orator. They were looking for Reagan. They were looking for FDR. They're looking for Obama. And Biden, I still like what Biden says. I just think he's getting a bad rap from both sides of the political aisle at this point for not, you know, being that orator like other people.
Well, Barack Obama was excellent at this. I criticized almost every policy he passed. But after Gabby Giffords was shot in Arizona, after the massacre in the church in North Carolina, he did play a healing role in this country because of his oratory, because of his being our first African-American president, because he had so much in his background and his natural abilities. He was excellent at that. The funny thing is, what Biden is good at is empathy. But that's different than the sort of soaring, inspiring rhetoric that you might want at a time like this, especially if you're in his party.
I agree with some of that. I want to challenge. I think, Tim, you kind of gave Biden Trump's quote about I alone can fix it. That's something literally Donald Trump said, and Biden had the opposite kind of platform for his campaign.
It was anybody but Trump can fix it.
Yes, which is all of us, I think, is how I hear that. And every president who says elect me and everything will be better, they, you know, all from all parties forget that they need all of us to kind of align with that continuously. But I think that we're exhausted. I'll speak for myself. I'm exhausted. I got moved by Obama's oratory. I got moved by John McCain's oratory. Like, Obama sang, you know, at the church in South Carolina. That was a beautiful moment. People are still getting shot up in churches. So I think we're all very cynical about the power of presidential oratory after moments of preventable carnage to prevent the next carnage, because it hasn't so far. And that, I don't put that on. Biden could be the best speaker in the world. People would still get shot up on the 4th of July, apparently.
Biden did get a win recently when he signed a bipartisan bill into law. It's the first gun reform legislation in some 30 years, and the bill includes money for states to run crisis intervention programs and incentives for states to pass red flag laws. That would help remove weapons from people deemed a threat to themselves or others. But since Biden signed it into law, there's been more than 30 mass shootings across the nation and 300 since the beginning of the year, according to the Gun Violence Archive. Biden spent all this political capital to get this legislation done, but Tim, could this backfire in getting any more legislation done? Because even though this bill was passed, mass shootings are still happening.
It's funny to me that Democrats and liberals always worry that taking a little half step will get in the way of them taking a full step. Because from my perspective on the right, what I've seen Democrats do is just constant incrementalism. They say, we need this one step. This is exactly what we need. And they take it. And then before their foot is even planted, they're demanding the next step. So as a tactical matter, no, I don't think that passing some gun control will get in the way of passing more. But I do think that where the line was drawn, where you were able to get some Republicans, was saying, we're not going to take away the Second Amendment rights of law-abiding citizens. And that, you know, what the Democrats are going to need to go further than that is enough public support in amending or scrapping the Second Amendment. And so they may have gone as far as they can in the time being. I don't think that'll stop them from going further in the future. I think what will stop them from going further in the future is that Americans see gun ownership as a civil liberty, and they don't want law-abiding people having that liberty taken away from them.
Baratunde, what does this do, though, in the average mind of the voter? Getting reform passed and then the very thing it's supposed to stop happens over and over and over again.
That's a constant feature of all kind of legislation. I'll agree with Tim that a half step is better than no step. I think this binary interpretation of like a gun for every baby versus like no guns for anyone ever, and I'm purposefully being a bit flamboyant and painting that picture, but with Tim, you said something about not restricting the right or not having the right to have a gun. The vast majority of Americans want some restrictions. And I think what gets extra frustrating and feeds the cynicism is that our political system is unable to reflect that more nuanced will of the people. This half measure was a step in the right direction, but it wasn't close to where overwhelming majorities, and when I say overwhelming, I'm talking like 88% of people who want these universal background checks. I'm talking about real red flag laws. I'm talking about common sense gun safety measures, like having to lock your gun up at home as a requirement of having one. We put so many regulations on so many things in this country, and I think Tim and I, you could probably find a lot of points of agreement that we overdo it in some realms. This isn't one of them. And to have a right to have a deadly weapon within reach of someone who's in a rage in a moment and wouldn't have the option to kill if it weren't for that gun, that doesn't seem like a right worth defending to that extreme point. And our system's not reflecting the deeper nuance that we feel as an overwhelming people. And that's very frustrating to a lot of us. I don't think that's a liberal thing. I think that's an American failure.
You mentioned the dualism, and like people who do want unfettered gun access, a regular pistol is no different for them than an AR-15. And I think most Americans at this point are like, look, you have these massacres with these guns that are meant for war. This is not something to scare someone off your lawn or to in self-defense. This is something to just wreck people, like rip them apart. That's where it comes to this issue of people saying, like, maybe if we showed photos of these victims at Highland Park, at, at Uvalde, all Buffalo, all these different places, that might push, especially the Democrats who go more far-reaching than what they are. Tim?
One of the problems with that argument is that the AR-15 is literally the most popular gun in America. So,
and what does that say about us?
The attempt to draw a distinction between sort of a gun that's used for hunting slash home defense slash self-defense versus a gun that's used for murder, for war. I mean, it's sort of automatic fire was the distinction that we drew. Like, automatic weapons are not good for home defense. They are only good for, for killing without regard for who you're even hitting. And so that's where, so we basically outlaw automatic weapons. It's very hard to get one or even to get a bump stock that emulates it. But on anything that's semi-automatic, where it's one round per pull, there's not really that distinction between weapons of murder and weapons of defense or sport. So if you want to change it, you're right. You've got to make America's gun culture change. And this is where I'm going to sound like a liberal, is that it's unhealthy, the degree to which when people put out their Christmas cards and it's got them with their 20 guns, including their 5 AR-15s. There is an unhealthy attachment to large arsenals or these big guns in America. And I think it stems from the fact that people are losing their attachments to other things. I would say church, community, a little league or anything like that, that the collapse of other sources of meaning causes people to look at a source of meaning that seems to empower them. This, again, is a cultural problem. Congress can't fix it. It can be fixed in the long run, but I don't think we agree on anything that can that would be better than gun culture. We're too at each other's throats right now.
Going back to the bill, which aligns with Biden's MO, the reaching across the aisle to get stuff done at this incremental pace to keep the peace, Baratunde, how much does that style of slow politicking help the Biden administration, if at all?
You know, Biden has found out, as a lot of presidents do with these, barely majorities in the Senate, that, we've heard it said before, every senator becomes the president with that veto power. Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema, with the thin Democratic majority, have a lot of power. And that limits the president, that's on the voters, that's also on the way we design our democracy to try to actually reflect the will of the people. That's on gerrymandering, that's on voter suppression efforts, that's on the Electoral College, that's on the Senate's increasingly disproportionate representation of farmland over people and cattle over people just because of population migration patterns towards cities. So that's going to be a reality that we got to deal with. I want to give this president, our president, credit. I want to give the people in Washington a half applause for getting, the bare minimum done. I hope we can expand our political imagination to just compare how we regulate automobiles. We've got different cylinders, we've got different classes of licensing, and just because this weapon, the AR-15 and its, copycats, is the most popular, doesn't mean we can't, restrict it. We've restricted a lot of popular things in this country, sometimes, in ways that have saved many, many lives. Driving drunk was very popular, and we stopped that. because it killed people.
I agree with that, but you're seeing all this Dem frustration, especially with the continued fallout from the Dobbs-Gotis ruling. This includes a CNN report this week that detailed a call between Biden and several celebrity Democratic donors, including an irate Deborah Messing, who said that she got Biden elected. And now that Roe versus Wade has been overturned, that there didn't seem to be a point in voting. And it's a critique being echoed by more and more Democrats, a lot of my friends, definitely. And as the midterms loom, that's bad. So is it smart for Dems to be angry right now at Biden at a time where they need every vote possible to stave off a red wave in November?
So my colleagues at PUC have written pretty extensively on this. Peter Hamby in particular wrote about the multi-decade effort that the right, to their credit, implemented. The Federalist Society focused on populating with their own flavor of activist judges. They're not in principle against activist judges as long as they act on behalf of their values and their interests. Same with regulation. They're not anti-regulation. They love to regulate women's bodies and choices. So it's all different flavors of things, but they committed in a deeper way than these like short-term cycles. It's almost like long-term investing versus quarterly earnings if you have run a public company. And I think the folks on the left and the Democratic Party specifically needs a massive renewal effort to dig deep and create these longer term plans. The sad fact is it took 40, 50 years to get to this point of really undoing, you know, this right, which is a relatively unprecedented direction for our country and for our Supreme Court. It may take that much time to reinforce that and to re-extend that right with a level of commitment that goes far beyond hitting me up with $15 fundraising texts to get more Democrats, you know, in Congress. That is a piece of the puzzle, but we got to go way deeper in different structures of our democracy to really, really ensure liberty and justice for all of us.
Tim, what's the risk for Biden to harness the energy and rage on the left right now? I mean, if ever there was a time to swing the Bernie way, you know, it seems like right now would be it.
No, I mean, on abortion, there is a small slice of the country that is overrepresented in our news media and in the Democratic Party leadership, and particularly in the Democratic Party fundraising circles, that is extremist on abortion. And they got almost every Democrat to vote for a bill a few weeks back, that would have basically forced even, would have taken away every state protection of the unborn, would have forced even a Catholic hospital to perform abortions, take away all conscience protections. That is an extremist position. If you look at polls that ask, there was recently Harvard and the Harris poll fielded a poll, and they said, do you think abortion should be, if in your state, would you like abortion to be legal throughout the whole pregnancy? And only 10% approximately said yes. And then if you said, how about at 15 weeks, you got 72% said that they would outlaw abortion after 15 weeks, except for cases of rape and incest, which is effectively what the Mississippi law did. So what you've got is a country that's pretty moderate on abortion and a Democratic Party whose leadership, fundraising base, and sort of media elites are far to the left. Biden is probably smart enough to know that right now there are certain states where abortion can be a winning issue for the Democrats, but for the most part, if they push the Democratic agenda, it would be branding them as an extremist party.
Oh, Tim, this is rich. This is beautiful. I love you, man. Because everything you said, I would say in the opposite direction. And therein lies, you know, some of the rub. I can cite a Pew study with a slightly, you know, different take on things, but it comes down to, for me, a headline of 72-ish% of folks think the decision should lie with the person that is pregnant. And I read like the footnotes of this study, and I hope this is valuable, not just for me to counter your point, but for anyone listening. A lot of us have strongly held moral beliefs that don't necessarily convert to legal beliefs. And so morality and legality or illegality can often be decoupled. And as with our gun discussion earlier, there's a level of nuance about abortion, which is poorly represented by many people on many sides of this issue because we all feel attacked. And we're like, well, we give you an inch, you're going to take a whole mile. And part of what I could point to right now is this, you know, 10-year-old in Ohio who's forced to give birth after being, you know, assaulted. That's an extremist view. I don't know what could be more extremist. And I can imagine, you know, someone with deeply held religious beliefs think it's extremist to conduct an abortion at any time. I just think we've got to fix the democracy to represent the nuance here and also be a little honest about, you know, returning things to the states, which was a core, you know, belief set of Alito's in his opinion. We're pushing this toward the states for democracy to have its way.
Yes.
But that same party, you know, the Republican Party, I'll name it, has co-signed an insurrection, yo.
But we're
having hearings about that right now. So it's very difficult for me to believe in good faith that this party wants to support local democracy with all the activities that it supported, which literally undermine democratic institutions.
How about this? I'm against an insurrection. I'm against storming the Capitol. I'm against all the crap Donald Trump did after the election. And I'm for states having the right to protect unborn children, because a fundamental role of government is to protect the innocent people from violence. And that's what you're doing when you are restricting or outlawing abortion. And if you can't at the same time say I'm a huge fan of democracy and then say I want the Supreme Court to be setting abortion laws. I agree democracy shouldn't touch everything, right? But in this particular case, Alito was right. There is no constitutional protection to abortion. It is left up to politics and democracy. The states and Congress. If we have this debate, come back here on this show 5 years from now, I think you'll be surprised at how centrist the country is on this issue.
We're going to have to leave it right there. Let's take a break. I'll be back with Baratunde Thurston of PUC, Tim Carney of the Washington Examiner and AEI to look at some big wins from NATO and G7 and what that may mean for Biden's unpopularity. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from across the political spectrum. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Gustavo Ariano, columnist at the Los Angeles Times, your guest host coming at you this time from the center. On the right, I'm joined by Tim Carney, columnist at the Washington Examiner and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. On the left is Baratunde Thurston. He's a founding partner at PUC, where he writes about democracy, race, technology, and climate. And he's also host of the new PBS show, America Outdoors. And I want to bring in our special guest, former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security, Juliette Kayyem. She's a professor of national security at Harvard University and author of the book, The Devil Never Sleeps, Learning to Live in an Age of Disasters. Hi, Juliet.
Hi, nice to be here.
We talked about Biden's struggles on his domestic agenda, but during his European trip last week, where he made appearances at both the G7 summit and the NATO summit, Biden made some favorable inroads abroad. Let's start with the G7 summit, which was held this year in Germany, and it's a meeting of advanced economies. And this year, Biden announced a $600 billion global infrastructure bill meant to counter China's reach. Juliet, this is actually a Biden effort from last year that they're relaunching this year. If they made little progress before, how's the Biden administration going to make any progress this year?
I think there's a lot more goodwill towards Biden in the United States 1 year later for two reasons. One is he's been president now, let's just say a lot later than when Trump was president. Remember, last year he's coming in just trying to remedy a lot of the fissures that had occurred during the previous administration. The second is the obvious one, which is Ukraine has changed almost everything, which is not simply the war in Ukraine, not simply trying to counter Russia influence, but the opportunity that the Ukraine war has given China on a variety of levels, whether they're economic, trade, or diplomatic. And so I think that that goodwill combined with, let's just give him credit, a pretty strong national security team that's doing a lot of back channeling, not in the forefront, lets him walk away from last week, both the G7 and then the potential expansion of NATO with Finland and Sweden, with some pretty significant wins, all of them admittedly somewhat defensive towards Russia or preparing ourselves to be defensive against Russia, as well as China.
Yeah, there was just that meeting or that press conference with members of what I think it was MI5 and the FBI saying, yeah, China is a big issue for both of us. Meanwhile, China has been building infrastructure through its so-called Belt and Road Initiative in developing countries for more than a decade. Juliet, can the U.S. compete with China on that grand scale?
I don't know. I'll be honest with you. Let me answer directly. If I were under oath, it really can't. And I think we shouldn't look at our posturing in that way, that there's going to be aspects to China's capabilities that we really can't compete with. One is just throwing a lot of money towards these developing countries so that they can build things quickly. A second, let's not forget, was China's attempts to have what we called vaccine diplomacy, which is to try to get lots of vaccines out into the world, the Chinese vaccines out into the world so that countries would be grateful and thankful. And then for China to take an opportunity of America's preoccupation, or as you said in the earlier segment, just sort of its divisions that make us look like we're not a very enviable country anymore. I mean, when you think about the China-U.S. divisions or conflicts. It really was based on an ideological notion that a free market or a strong market could only exist in a free society. China has essentially disproved that. There's a lot of complaints about China and human rights and all sorts of other things. But, you know, there is another model out there. And a lot of countries will look to the United States and say, gosh, that model of division and unrest and not getting anything done and not being able to move smoothly or swiftly on big projects is not necessarily a beneficial model. So I don't know if I would say I would view it as a competition. It would just be in our different orbits of influence. Can we remain competitive with China, but also allied with China for all sorts of benefits that we get of having an alliance with a market as large as China's is? I'll tell you, you know, we're sort of, this is an under the radar thing, but a new law was passed just swiftly without much thought that potentially penalizes companies that might have any tangential involvement, trade, market, supply chain with the horrible human rights abuses of the Uyghurs in China. This could impact, you know, tens to hundreds of thousands of companies. That's not a very effective way, I think, to move forward in a market economy in which we're going to have to align with a lot of Chinese companies to continue to be technologically advanced, militarily advanced. And so I would say broad statements about human rights that we saw in that Uyghur legislation is probably, I think, in the end, not going to prove very fruitful to make the kind of point that we wanted to make.
China was also on the mind at NATO at the summit, and where there were other concrete plans announced. You mentioned the membership bids for Finland and Sweden. Even President Erdogan of Turkey agreed to lift his objections to that at the strong urging of President Biden. How do you see Biden's influence abroad, and how does that compare to his influence here in the United States on domestic issues?
Yeah, you know, I'm not an expert in polling, but I don't know how much this benefits him domestically, even though it is a very sophisticated, I think it was a very sophisticated play on the Biden administration's part. They did not call out Turkey very publicly. They did sort of the back channel discussions. They let Finland and Sweden take the lead in negotiations with Turkey. We obviously do not know what promises were made to Turkey. There's conversations about a bilateral meeting between Turkey and the United States, between Biden and Erdogan. And so that may be the result of this. Turkey has problems with Finland and Sweden based on some sanctions, as well as their alleged retention of terrorists or people that the Turks claim are terrorists in their countries. I think those were probably easily resolved. And then now we move forward. So it was a huge success. How that translates domestically, I don't know. I don't know at this stage whether geopolitical successes are perceived as well as geopolitical failures are. And I just am alluding to Afghanistan. I mean, if you really look at where Biden's domestic polling problems came into play, it really was the withdrawal in Afghanistan. And it seems that he has not been able to sort of regroup that since.
Julia, please convince me that 100% that Finland and Sweden joining NATO is good for the United States. It seems like now we're expanding the circle of countries who we would be obligated to protect, that it could provoke Putin into being more aggressive, in fact, towards Finland or Sweden, and that the United States' interests, it's hard to see directly how it's affected here. So please make the case to me that this is, in fact, a success.
Well, I would say in the absence of what Putin did, I wouldn't have been for this. I mean, I NATO seemed fine as it was. We had commitments to countries that also had commitments to us. But that changed for me. And here's how I'll try to convince you: is after the invasion, and then the first couple weeks when it became clear that this was not going to be easy for Russia, and it was not going to be decisive for Ukraine. I mean, in other words, neither country, let's looking at the war, is strong enough to win decisively, but neither is weak enough to lose decisively. So I think we're looking at a sort of a long-term Eastern Ukrainian ugliness. So if that's the case, then you want to get the wins or the defenses or the barriers in the ways that you can without military effort. And that's where Finland and Sweden come in. It is simply, you know, I would say putting a little bit of salt on the wound of what happened in Russia. So does that obligate us in any way? That makes me worry. Not really, because I think Putin's decision to advance past Ukraine was already decided, right? I mean, in other words, he knows he does not have the capacity to do that now, given their failures in Ukraine. But the idea that you now have a stronger defense is almost without a lot of obligation on the United States part, but is symbolically significant to keep Putin in year 3, 4, or 5, whatever's going to happen in the years to come, at bay. And I'm not just talking about military efforts here. I mean, you know, one of the interesting in my world, one of the questions I have is, why didn't Putin unleash a cyber war? That's what we all anticipated in the homeland security space, is just our critical infrastructure. He would do a cheap war to engage us. And I really actually think that what NATO was saying in the lead up to the war, that a cyber attack into NATO, which had significant consequences for civilian society, say a cyber attack against a water supply or electrical supply, would be viewed as an attack under Article 5. That's important because the next move may not be military, it might be cyber. So I've changed since his invasion of Ukraine. I would have never thought that this was either necessary or beneficial to have more countries join NATO. I felt that way, honestly, about Turkey, but now it is an appropriate response.
And I would remind Tim that Sweden and Finland wanted to join NATO, and hey, free countries and all that. But Baratunde, really quickly, how much does the average voter care about all these deals reached or announced at either of these summits?
Couple of thoughts. One, I just want to acknowledge my colleague, Julia Ioffe, over at PUC, who's written extensively on the situation in Ukraine and undermined my early belief that, if it's because of the expansion of NATO that Putin wants to invade, and he just kind of undermined his own logic. Like he caused NATO to expand with this invasion. She's also written and covered some of this G7 NATO stuff that Juliet's talking about. And I think the U.S. voter should be intrigued with the idea of a $600 billion infrastructure deal, abroad, one that, was so, so very hard to get in place here at home. I think, we've had the luxury of these big oceans separating us. Cyber shrinks that, and we've had, acts of cyber war by Russia already, in our country in terms of interference in our election, in terms of turning, our racial discord into racial flames and turning Black Lives Matter activists, fake pop-up Facebook groups, et cetera. So we're already kind of in the mix. And it's just nice, I think, for a voter to horrifically remember the levels of embarrassment that many of us felt when Donald Trump was president representing us on the world stage. With behavior, with language, with tone that we wouldn't want our own children to display. And just to have like basic blocking and tackling and competence elevated again, it may not move the needle with people's worries about gas prices, but I think that form of leadership does matter, and we can be proud again, even as we disagree on policy points, that our president isn't embarrassing us on a global stage on a regular basis.
Tim, I take it you don't believe Biden can take a victory lap on this.
I mean, people don't care about foreign policy, sadly, unless you launch a really mistaken war. And even then, sometimes, I mean, Barack Obama got away with his unauthorized, ill-advised war in Libya. I don't think it's going to it's going to move votes. I think he had some losses. He tried to move the G7 against Russian oil, which probably wouldn't have worked, and that's why they put him in place. But it's good to have a guy who's respected around the world, and I agree that his foreign policy team is probably the strongest part of his administration, in part because he's avoided getting us into bad wars like the previous presidents did.
I've been talking with Baratunde Thurston of PUC and Tim Carney of the Washington Examiner and AEI, and special guest, former Assistant Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, Juliet Kayyem. We'll be back with the Political Halftime Report looking toward the midterms. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Thanks for listening to Left, Right, and Center. Is there someone in your life who could benefit from hearing a civilized discussion from all sides? Share the show with them. You can stream all episodes at kcrw.com/LRC. Straight from the KCRW app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your guest host, Gustavo Arellano, columnist at the Los Angeles Times. On the left is Baratunde Thurston. He's a founding partner at PUC, where he writes about democracy, race, technology, and climate. He's also the host of the PBS show American Outdoors. From the right, we're joined by Tim Carney, columnist at the Washington Examiner and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. And our special guest, former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security, Juliet Kayyem. She's a professor of national security at Harvard University. We're well into the 2022 midterms. Dozens of states have held primaries already, and former President Donald Trump endorsed more than 200 candidates, according to the New York Times. Some are winning, some are losing. I want to do a roundup of winners and losers so far. So, Tim, let's start with you. Who are some notable winners?
Well, politically, you've got Ron DeSantis is the biggest winner. He has played very well, managing to get attacked last year for prioritizing the elderly in handing out the vaccines and going toe-to-toe with some businesses and not backing down. So he's sort of owning the libs in a way that Donald Trump did, but he's also advancing policies that are popular and I think will be helpful in his state. So I see him as a big winner. And to that extent, Trump is the loser because Donald Trump was sort of the king of the hill in the Republican Party, and now he has an actual rival.
Baratunde, Europe, winners, losers, who are you looking at?
There's some winning I hope continues to happen here in the Los Angeles area where I live with Karen Bass and her defeat, not complete defeat, but her leadership, you know, coming out of the primary for mayor of Los Angeles against Rick Caruso, whose dollar per voter spend should really question people's views of how good this guy is with money. I think it's good to have an actual Democrat running this city. I think there's been some interesting local races here with nuance around the use of police force, not, you know, some of the extreme language we've been hearing in many different directions, but redirection of funds toward mental health, disarming of some traffic, you know, stops, and maybe even moving that out of the realm of armed response to kind of disarm and de-escalate from the get. People's fears that somebody in the situation might have a gun. There's also been a lot of good things happening from a progressive perspective on the ground, and I would point people to the Movement Voter Project, which is highlighting the types of stories that we don't hear in the major national and nationalized news about what's happening in the country, and it can bolster your sense of progress, hope, and where you can put your own resources if you're a progressive who wants to move the country forward in that direction.
How about losers? Who do you think is a big loser so far in the midterms? Besides Rick Caruso, of course.
I mean, reasonable debate is losing. I think people who are frustrated about the Supreme Court's activities, you know, we all feel like we are losing in terms of where we can place our energy. And as far as DeSantis, my colleague, I'm doing a lot of PUC plugging, but I'm just very proud of my colleagues. Tara Palmieri has a really interesting interview with Ro Khanna, Representative Ro Khanna, who would disagree with Tim about the relative strength of Trump versus DeSantis. And his analysis was that, you know, DeSantis is slick and savvy and calculating. He lacks emotional appeal. And so I wouldn't declare victory for DeSantis just yet. He hasn't been tested on that national stage to see if he can really resonate in the way that Trump clearly could. As ineloquent as the guy is, he speaks at a deep level that many of us wrote off. And he's still a very effective communicator, bad grammar at all. So I don't know that DeSantis can yet be declared a winner. I'm very interested to see what happens with the South Florida contingent and the battles there.
Tim, defend your man.
Maybe DeSantis needs worse grammar, if I'm gathering what Baratunde said.
Hey, ask the voters, not me. I don't choose either of them. So this is your party.
It's too early to declare that anybody's a favorite over Trump. He is, unfortunately, a totem of the GOP, but he had no threats until now, was what I was trying to say. And DeSantis is a threat.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
Julia, any particular race that you're paying attention to?
Not a race, but if I could do a winner and a loser as I thought about it. So a winner, I would say, is Governor Pritzker of Illinois. One does not want to look at mass shootings in the political sense. But if you define politics as leadership, right, and helping communities, I think I've been overwhelmed. I spent a lot of time for CNN on TV with all these mass shootings. I think we've benefited from steady leadership through yet another gun crisis. I think what is happening in Illinois in terms of the transparency, the press conferences every 2 hours, the numbers and data and facts that seem reliable, the not jumping to conclusions for every Twitter storm that comes out alleging X, Y, or Z, is just a steadiness that I appreciate as someone who looks at crises and mass shootings and things, you know, what does the community need? And so you see a leader, and there's all sorts of speculation about his plans. The leaders are, with a steady hand, but an honest one, and speaking to the community, not speaking to us or the Twitter sphere or, cable news. And that's really beneficial in a crisis. It's the work that I do, which is, I always say a leader just needs to provide numbers and hope, numbers about what's happening. People deserve to know the facts, and then hope about how might it get better. And he's used this opportunity to do both while still being very pro-gun restriction legislation, against military style weapons and other things like that, and has done so in a good manner. So I look at, everything is political in some ways. We're a democracy, but I do think it's worth noting how different that is, say, from, Governor Abbott in Texas after the Uvalde school shooting and killings. It's just such a different way of thinking about your role. I want to say, I think Trump is a huge loser this week. If you look at the January 6th committee and the investigation, In the counter-radicalization, counter-terrorism lens that I tend to do, the people on the left, and I spend a lot of time on Twitter, really want an indictment. They want Trump in an orange jumpsuit. That's sort of the focus. And if you measure success by only one metric, you're bound to fail often. I think this was one of the problems with what people were hoping what happened with the Mueller report. I look at it differently and wrote about this in The Atlantic, which is, if you really think about Trump as the leader of a violent movement, I mean, he's just promoting violence as an extension of politics. And you could call it terrorism, you could call it whatever you want, an insurrection, I could care less in that sense. Then the goal is, how do you isolate him? How do you minimize him? How do you make him look like a loser? And because that's very hard to recruit people to a violent effort, and this applies to the mob, to terrorist groups, whatever else, if the leader is not winning, and looks like a jerk, and someone who's doing all sorts of horrible things. And I think in the last week, since in terms of the committee hearings, that what they've exposed is not only the planning that obviously was being done for the insurrection, but the extent to which Trump was madman, and not having his bearings, and that he was surrounded by people who were trying to attempt to tell him otherwise. I'm not going to defend those people, but I think the committee is providing an off-ramp, is what I called it, which is what you need to do for any violent group, an off-ramp for people to say, we're no longer with him. I think DeSantis is taking advantage of that, but there's other metrics that are showing it. Some of it is the polling, of course, and some of it is, where's the money going in some of these Republican races? So I think it was a horrible week for Trump, and a very good week for the anti-violence elements within our democracy, not just any party, in the last week.
And nevertheless, throughout this primary season, election fraud claims and misinformation continue to be talking points for several Republican candidates. And if these candidates win in the midterms, and some have already won, actually, or at least going into the general election, they could profoundly shape the future of democracy. Tim, do you think these denialism candidates have a shot at winning? And how much should the rest of us be concerned?
I don't think on statewide levels they're going to win. I mean, Republicans have harmed themselves with some of the people they're nominating on these statewide races are going to go down. I mean, the number one thing that Donald Trump wants Republicans to talk about is the 2020 election being stolen. And the number one thing that normal conservative centrist voters want behind them is Donald Trump complaining about the 2020 election being stolen. I mean, as a sports fan, you could agree with somebody that an umpire robbed somebody from a call and still want them to shut up about it and go out and win the next game. But in this case, Trump is wrong, and he's just selfish, and he's just looking, and it's going to hurt them on a statewide level. On a congressional district level, look, I mean, you get people like Maxine Waters and Marjorie Taylor Greene can get elected, so anybody can win.
No,
the House
they're nowhere near the same. Come on.
No, they're not near the same, but they're both extremists who aren't necessarily attached to reality. But yeah, on a congressional level, anyone can win.
And Trump's endorsement, though, still has a lot of clout.
It does. And if we're doing this halftime show, I would say the number one interesting trend that's underappreciated in the first half of this year has been, if you look at Blake Masters, a Republican running for Senate in Arizona, and you look at J.D. Vance in Ohio, what you've got going on is people who are seeing the populist working class vein that Trump is tapping into and trying to put an intellectual conservative actual meat on those bones. That Trump was just channeling an emotion, a fervor, and that Blake Masters just comes out and he says, what does Make America Great Again mean? Well, Blake Masters says, how about we have an America where you can raise a family securely on a single income? I have no idea how he's going to make that happen, but that's something that a lot of people are like, yes, that was good that my parents could do that, and I wish we could do it now. They're putting meat on the bones of Make America Great Again. That's the most underappreciated trend of the first half of this year.
Baratunde, do you think intellectual Trumpism has a chance to win?
I think that disease has already metastasized and found its way poisoning the body politic in so many parts of the country, especially at the state level with elections officials. You know, my harsh view, and it's not my only view, but my harsh view of the Republican Party is that it's dominated by people who don't believe in government, who want to take the reins of government. This narrower set doesn't believe in democracy at all and wants to take the reins of democracy. So that deeply concerns me. I know that's not everybody, but it's enough to cause a lot of chaos. I also need to take a moment to put some respect back on Representative Maxine Waters' name. She is nowhere near the same category of leader, of human, of just decent person when compared to someone like Marjorie Taylor Greene. One of these people had the foresight to fight to end apartheid. One of these people had the foresight to get us out of Iraq, a place that we never should have been, you know, going back to this topic of wars that we shouldn't have, you know, picked a fight with. And Marjorie Taylor Greene is a radical influencer who happens to be in Congress at this point. And so I find that comparison very off. And I just, you know, as someone who I deeply respect, me and Maxine Waters, I want to represent her quality representation as very distinct from whatever Marjorie Taylor Greene is doing in the House of Congress right now.
But one can condemn Marjorie Taylor Greene without bringing anyone else into it. I think most people, I mean, she's on air like this week talking about how the killing in Highland Park was a false flag. I mean, I just think some people can stand alone. We don't always need to sort of say, and then, you know, the left has this person, because I think condemning her as a solo, you know, insanity and who ought not to be representing anyone, then actually can unify people across very divided politics to say, okay, well, we're going to disagree on major, major issues, abortion, gun rights, whatever. But there are some people who should not be, I mean, you know, I don't even know if she should you know, be out in the world, she kind of scares me. Something's off with her, but who should certainly not be in Congress. You know, her false flag statements about school shootings and what happened in Highland Park are just, like, there's no comparison.
Tim, quick response.
I mean, yes, she's the worst person in Congress by a large margin. Granted.
Well, at least we could agree on that. Lastly, and just really quickly, folks, how much will the overturning of Roe influence the midterms? Do the majority of Americans who didn't want Roe versus Wade overturned per years of Gallup polls rush to the ballot box and exact revenge on this Republican Party? Baratunde.
I have stopped predicting electoral outcomes. I think it's a dangerous practice and a loose art form. I just hope we all remember that the best predictor of election outcomes is determined by people who show up and vote. And I know, I speak from personal experience about feeling disheartened and feeling like there's no chances, but it's not over till it's over. And even when it's over, we in this country have proven a chance to renew and resurge in multiple directions. You know, the right thought it was over with Roe, and then they came back 50 years later and flipped that script. So I want people to maintain a sense of possibility and not lean into the predictive punditry too much. And I'm speaking to myself right now.
Tim?
I think that, I mean, yeah, anybody who asks my predictions, I say go back to 2016 and read my article headlined, "No, Donald Trump Can't Win," and then you stop asking me my predictions. But I will say that, you know, if we on the show love and care about democracy, and what Dobbs did is it returned abortion into the realm of democracy. And some of the results are going to be bad for pro-lifers. Some of the results are going to be bad for pro-choicers. So a lot are going to be bad for politicians who wanted to dodge the issue. And that's what politics is. That's what democracy is. It's rough and tumble. It's unpredictable, as we were just saying. But ultimately, it leads to more social peace when people have a say. When you fight, make your case, even if you lose, you can accept the result if you got to have your say. That's what democracy is about. I think in 10 years, we will agree that it's been good for social peace in this country that abortion was moved from the, you know, a handful of judges in robes back to the American people.
And we'll leave it at that. Juliet Kayyem, former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security, professor of national security at Harvard University, and author of the book, The Devil Never Sleeps, Learning to Live in an Age of Disasters. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to have to leave it there. We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Tim Carney, it's your soapbox.
On this year's Independence Day, you had animal rights protesters interrupt and disrupt the hot dog eating contest. Now, a lot of people think the hot dog eating contest is a great American tradition. I think it's gross. I would not have stormed up on stage with them. And I don't just think it's disgusting. I actually think that it is totally unbefitting that we should turn this feast of gluttony into a celebration. I'm going to get a little churchy. I'm a Catholic. I'm a Christian. I believe that God gave us so much of creation for us to use for our own enjoyment because it's good. Food is there to keep us alive and for us to enjoy, and it tastes good. It is gluttonous and it's wasteful, particularly to be shoving 65 hot dogs into your mouth in a minute because the animals were put here for us to have dominion over them to use responsibly with love, not to use in such a grotesque show. So this is my very curmudgeonly conservative opinion on the 4th of July. Please, let's find a different way to celebrate our country besides an orgy of gluttony.
Baratunde Thurston, what's your rant?
Hear, hear, Tim. If hot dogs should be eaten at all, they should be eaten very slowly. You got my cosign on that one. There's a lot that is upsetting in the country right now. I sympathize with people who are hurting from and who will be hurt by the Supreme Court decision, especially when it's paired with the fact that the conservative majority was appointed by presidents who won minority, you know, of the votes. So democracy has some funky twists and knots in it. However, I want to celebrate a couple of things in my rant. I want to celebrate a group called Chicago Cred, which has been working in the community on reducing gun violence and been very effective. Homicides in that city down 10%. in the CRED neighborhoods that are down 30 and 50%. I want to celebrate a group called Community Solutions, which has a great website, community.solutions, which has a program to actually end homelessness, which is plaguing all kinds of states, regardless of the politics. We know how to do this. We need to scale it up. And I want to plug everyone who has found a way not to have dominion over animals and nature, but to have relationship with animals and nature. It's something I got to see up close and personal in my PBS series, America Outdoors. And seeing this country for all of its ecological diversity paired with its human diversity remind me to take that asset-based view of the country, or allow me to love and see the beauty of America in a deeper sense, and allow me to heal some of the things that have been traumatizing me. So I encourage us all to go outside, not in a spirit of dominion, but in a spirit of relationship, and reconnect with that part of us, that non-human part of us, that is also deserving of life and liberty and the pursuit of what passes for happiness for all of them. Beautiful country we got. Let's keep it.
Absolutely. And now for my rant. Are you looking for a summer read? I've got one. Bad Mexicans, Race, Empire, and Revolution in the Borderlands. Incredible book by UCLA professor and MacArthur genius Kelly Lytle Hernandez about the Magón brothers, the intellectual architects of the Mexican Revolution. Her book reads like a movie and just brings it. Flawed heroes, transnational chases, mystery, and a protagonist known as, I'm not kidding, Mr. Apple. Bad Mexicans has been out since May and deserves to be a national bestseller, got a national release, but so far it's not. There's been a big push in recent years for diverse representation in media, especially in the book industry. Well, here's a book that does just that, written by an author of color, and people aren't rushing out to buy it. Shame on anyone who hasn't bought Bad Mexicans yet, but shame especially on Latinos. If we can't support a great story about us, who will? This sad state of literary affairs reminds me of that bitter Mexican saying, por eso estamos como estamos. That's why we are where we are. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks to Baratunde Thurston and Tim Carney. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Jenna Cagle. The show is recorded and mixed by Matt Schwartz. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Gustavo Ariano. Thanks for joining us. Tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center. Gracias.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.